Now, HomePods Destroy.
Hello, and thank you for downloading HomePods Destroy. I'm Terry DeFellin. If you're listening to this podcast for the first time, then this is a Star Trek discussion podcast that focuses predominantly on the original series from the 1960s. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, then we would be very grateful if you would subscribe via Apple Podcasts or any other catcher that you use, and even more grateful if you left us a favourable review about the show. That would make us feel very good about what we're doing, but more importantly, it increases the profile of the show on these podcatching services. Links to our feeds are on the show notes, so why not subscribe right now? The episode we're discussing is Charlie X from the first season, and as always, it will be heavily spoiled. So if you've not seen Charlie X for a while or at all, then by all means pause this episode and join us after you've given it a watch.
Gentlemen, Rand, this is Charles Evans. Show him to his quarters and drop his records off at Dr. McCoy's office, if you will.
Yes, sir. Come with me, please.
Girl? Is that a girl?
That's a girl.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Terry DeFellin and I'm joined by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And by Derek Mantle.
Hello.
How are we doing, chaps? All right?
Yeah, fine. How are you?
Jolly good. Yes, I'm very well. I'm full of Christmas cheer. Or, in this case, I'm full of raki, which is a Greek liqueur, I can only assume, or that is stripping the insides of my body as we speak. It's a tremendous fun.
Yeah. And I've got some DIY when I get home, so I've just stripped some walls.
So I'll just breathe on any paint you need stripping.
I thought you could have put some blue food colouring in this. Well, so it would be.
Have we got any blue?
What a good idea! I wouldn't know about that. I wouldn't know about that.
That would certainly sort of be in an odd-shaped bottle. You could say, isn't this illegal?
No, bones. Is it illegal? It's Christmas time as we're recording. It's the week-ish before Christmas as we're recording this. And the likelihood is that you'll be able to download it from just before Christmas 2017. So if that's the case, then season's greetings to you from everyone here at HomePods Destroy. We hope it's a good one for you. Chaps, it's quite a time to be into Star Trek, isn't it? Star Trek Discovery is on its mid-season break, for those of us who are watching it, Graham. But also this extraordinary news about Quentin Tarantino and the fourth film. Are you across this?
I heard about this.
Only from what you've said on Twitter about the physical
tweets. The situation is this. He's written a story. He's pitched it to J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams likes the story, unsurprisingly, and has formed a writer's room. And they're going to bash out a script for the next, a Star Trek movie. It may well be that it's not the next Star Trek film, but it's certainly going to be a Star Trek film. And the deal is, so far,
they've replaced Kirk with Samuel Jackson.
No, well, I wasn't going to say that, but I mean,
Harvey Keitel.
I could cope with all of those scenarios easily. But the deal is that if everyone is happy with the script, then Tarantino will direct the picture, which is extraordinary. I don't know whether or not that's likely. What do you think, guys?
I didn't know that actually Tarantino was a bit of a Trekkie.
Yeah, he's a mad Trekkie. Okay. He loves Star Trek. Yeah, he particularly enjoys the original series. He says yesterday's Enterprise, the TNG episode, is his favourite ever Star Trek story, which is a good episode.
Yeah.
A fine episode. Do you think it's likely? What do you think?
Who knows? Because, you see, there is lots of stuff with Star Trek. There is another film coming out just in the new year, which, not to do with Star Trek per se, but is actually about... and I've seen the trailer, it's brilliant. I can't remember the actual film, but it's about an autistic girl who is a mad Star Trek fan, and she travels across America by herself to deliver a Star Trek script.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You have to check this out. I can't remember who it is. Mm. It's the actress who's in it is... Is it the girl who plays Danger Girl in the Kick-Ass films? I might be wrong. But the trailer looks lovely, very heartfelt. But there is a lot of Trek at the moment coming out. There's things like this.
Yeah. Well,
there's a lot of politicians who have been tweeting Trek stuff, I've noticed. Clive Lewis was going on about it, about that asteroid. That was
Well, we've all seen that, but only thought of one thing.
Exactly. Yeah. As long as it wasn't that bloody whale thing with that bit of foil that sort of all that was.
Yeah, well, you always wondered. So you don't realise until how much a movie has set itself into a culture until something similar arrives from another solar system to jog everyone's memory. Tarantino is an exciting idea of doing that. I think it's probably worth bearing in mind that it wouldn't necessarily be a signature Tarantino movie. He has directed studio stuff before, mostly for television. He's done ER, he's done CSI. So, I mean, he's capable of directing within the studio franchise environment.
Certainly, yeah.
I think he's got the disciplines. He's not he's an auteur, but he's not unprofessional. I think he knows the score.
Yeah, exactly.
And we won't be, if people are worried about some of the excesses of Tarantino's movies, I think that your franchise is going to be pretty safe.
No, you've got to look at it and you'll see, well, if he's your fan,
he's going to treat it with respect. Yeah. He's going to want to produce a Star Trek film, direct a Star Trek film.
That's not what he's going to want to
something
do.
Else.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, you know, why would he do it to begin with? So I think we could possibly, his bent for nostalgia may be an indication for what might, and the fact that, you know, the current movies are set in this kind of sort of alternate TOS timeline, which makes podcasts like Whom Pods Destroy all the more relevant, if you want my opinion.
You make a valid point there, because he's very much in his 1960s kick still. You remember he wanted to do the Green Hornet and also The Man from U.N.C.L.E. at one time?
Yeah, it would have been really good if he'd done The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Green Hornet. Actually, I've not seen Man from U.N.C.L.E., but Green Hornet is...
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. is
enjoyed it.
They are films. They are films. They are things that you can watch for a couple of hours.
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't go to the cinema to see it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we went to Green Hornet, didn't we?
It was a way to fill a couple of hours.
Sure.
I mean, you can see if you're a big fan of it, then you would have been horrifically disappointed by it.
But we weren't, so that's fine.
Yeah,
maybe that's why I haven't seen Man from U.N.C.L.E. yet. Anyway, on to the discussion of our programme. I can't segue in, sadly. I was about to, but I couldn't segue in. We're talking about Charlie X, which is a first season episode. Actually, the second episode of Star Trek screened on our television after The Man Trap. So it's quite a departure from The Man Trap. But very brief summary. Charlie Evans is a 17-year-old boy who has been stranded on a planet on his own after a space crash. All of his family dead from the age of 3, and he's been able to live on his own. And he's recovered. He's rescued by a supply ship, Antares, who then turn him over to the Enterprise, who are then going to take him back to Colony 5 to resettle him. And Spock is a little bit concerned about how he's managed to survive on that planet, and whether or not, he speculates whether or not he had the help of these mythical creatures who are said to not exist, the Thasians. And he wonders whether or not he had some help. And it turns out that he did. And we find out very quickly why and what and the extent of his power. So why don't we begin then with Charlie X. When I was a kid, the first time I watched this episode of Star Trek, I don't remember. But I do know that I did watch it, because when I was a kid, I was watching a rerun of TOS, of Charlie X. My mum was in the kitchen. She looked over the TV and saw me watching. And said, "Oh, no, not that one." She said, "The last time that was on, you kept doing that thing with the eyes." And I had to... I couldn't stop you from doing it. So I know I'd seen it before. When Charlie comes on board, he instantly latches himself onto Captain Kirk.
Yeah, the father figure. I was just saying, rather than the father figure thing, is that my missus actually saw me watching a bit of this, and she spotted the bit with the gym. And she said, "Oh no, not another homoerotic Kirk episode."
This one is particularly homoerotic. There's a lot of sweaty men flying around in this one.
I was going to ask you, actually, in fairness, about the gym sequence. You're au fait with the remasters and the originals. I mean, how does Kirk's stomach look in the original version? Because it looks great in the remasters.
No, it's fine. They haven't done anything to it. He is holding it in, I think it's safe to say.
he is definitely holding it.
But, you know, when a man reaches a certain age, it's probably good for his core strength to do a bit of...
Exactly.
Because we're all of a certain age now where we all have bellies. And I was thinking, man, and we've all are at a point where, you know, we're man enough to admit that we hold them in from time to time. Dear God, the guy's going to burst something if he doesn't breathe out soon. Poor chap.
Yeah. Anyway, you were going back to the father figure thing.
Carry on.
Yeah, sorry, that was a little bit of a diversion. But it was similar sort of thing as your mum saying about not one of those episodes again. So, you're right. The father figure. I mean, that's the whole structure of the story. He is the father figure, the favourite figure of authority.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite interesting that when you introduced it to Charlie, he's beamed on board with the two other. Was it members of the crew from the other ship, the Antares?
Yeah.
And when they want to start chatting away, you can see that the hesitance from them, and then obviously he uses his powers to big himself up to Kirk, you know, and then that's your first inkling that something strange is happening here, you know.
The whole father thing, though, the only reason it's there is so that Charlie can rebel against his parent. And that's so Kirk is instantly transformed into a parent figure, just so Charlie can rebel against him for the purposes of the story. And it works pretty well because Kirk has power over him to begin with, and it's gradually chipped away until eventually Charlie doesn't do anything that he says. But it is done in such it's done so well by the principal actors that You get away with it in quite a short space of time.
Yeah.
But you still keep feeling that Kirk can negotiate with him, that he can pull him back from what he's trying to do. And then at the end, like, Kirk really does, you know, he loses all sort of semblance of trying to control him and thinks, right, well, I've just got to fight him. I've just got
to take
him down.
If he can take
him. Well, he's actually on Charlie's side for quite a bit of,
it
in the beginning, that he's just a kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know...
And he can handle it, and, you know,
yeah.
It's a bit of a parenting thing, isn't it? You try to reason, and you try to persuade, you try to deal with a problem child, you know, in a non-violent way. But obviously, then at some point, presumably, if things are uncontrollable, then you end up resorting to violence. That's probably not really a message that resonates through the years, is it?
No, well, it does now. I mean, it's 51 years ago that's done. So it's, you know, half a century.
Yeah, but it's not in any parenting handbooks that I'm aware of. Is it sort of like if your child is proving to be too difficult, too troublesome, then, you know, beat them up?
Well, yeah, but then again, most parenting books is what to do if your child develops godlike abilities. That's not
true. Yeah. I haven't seen it.
Now, this episode borrows a lot from a Twilight Zone episode, doesn't it?
It does. The good life.
Yeah.
It's a good life, I should say.
It's a good life. Now, of course, in Twilight Zone episodes, you don't have to have a resolution. You don't have to to defeat the monster because you know the stories are contained and they begin and end in one episode. Except that one, because they do actually make a sequel of it in a later reboot of the Twilight Zone.
Oh, do they? I mean, I'm aware of the remake of it in the movie, but do they go back to it?
Bill Murray reprises his role, and it's got his daughter in it.
Yes, indeed. It's a Good Life, written by Jerome Bixby, of course.
Yes.
Mirror. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
This episode is written by Dorothy Fontana. Story by Jean, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
It's directed by Lawrence Dobkin, who's an actor. Mostly famous for playing character actors in really, really good films that you've seen, but not in any role that you particularly remember.
Okay, because it's a tight episode.
Day the Earth Stood Still, he was in that, wasn't he? He was the doctor in that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was looking through his Wikipedia filmography, and it's prodigious. Yeah. And he's done loads of stuff. But he also did a fair amount of directing as well. Okay. And he directed this episode, and you're right. It's very tight indeed.
Roddenberry's writing credit was basically for a one-line description of what the story was going to be.
Yeah.
Good old Gene.
But I think it is interesting that this is a Dorothy Fontana episode because there's a lot of feeling about how this episode treats women.
I was thinking that as well,
and I think a lot of the criticism that this episode gets, and quite rightly when viewed with more modern eyes, is how Charlie behaves towards women, the female crew members on the
Enterprise. But the thing is that at the start of the way he interacts with women, when he does that inappropriate slap on the bottom, I mean, for me, I read that as being he was straight away he was castigated for it, which is what we would see, and then obviously at that time, 50 years ago, them to put that in is obviously a thing that was actually could be happening to people. And obviously DC Fontano's, you know, she's bringing this up. She's actually making a point here, you know, very overt.
Yeah.
You got a deal, friend.
Charlie?
I thought... Don't be angry, I did. I wanted...
Charlie, you just don't go around slapping girls on the... Just don't do it again.
And there are very, very much... I mean, the thing is, it's a broad canvas, isn't it?
The stuff
that's actually going in there is very overt to show the way men behave with women.
What sort of point do you think she's making about Kirk's inability to explain why slapping a girl's ass is not cool?
Well, there's no right way to hit a woman. I mean, man to man is one thing. But man and woman... It's another thing. Do you understand?
I don't know.
Captain Kirk.
Excuse me.
Well, that's usually either two reasons. One, obviously, the social mores at the time, it wasn't seen as being actually a problem.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a problem. It wasn't a major problem for them. It was more of the problem was to do with like the female sex and attraction and all this other stuff. And also from the father's point of view, Kirk as a father, it led up into a maybe Kirk would have to explain the birds and the bees as well.
There was that little interplay isn't there between
especially with McCoy
and Spock and Kirk are trying to pass around the unhappy task of teaching
because in the 23rd century people just don't talk about that
stuff. they don't talk about sex with minors, and they don't play massive multiplayer role playing games or anything like that in their spare time. They play cards.
Yeah.
It's nice to see.
Or 3D chess.
That's right. They play these wholesome sort of like analog activities, reflective of the needs of their audience.
And they don't play any electronic instruments. They play lyres.
They do indeed. Yes.
Well, I'm sure it's slightly electronic.
It has got a nice bit of reverb afterwards, hasn't it?
That scene in we're talking of that scene in the rec deck. Or the rec room again. It's another Lower Decks thing, isn't it? It's indicative of those early episodes where the series was going to go one way. It looked like it might have been going one way. It might have been more like a kind of a Next Gen kind of ensemble. Disappointed that it went. I get a certain nostalgic ache for those kind of scenes and wish we had more of those.
Yeah, I think you do see a sort of. An idea of the intention of where the series was meant to be going, especially with the use of Uhura there, getting quite a nice little cameo there.
Mm.
But also, I think with the whole nature of Yeoman Rand as well, and about what her role was on the ship and her role is within the ensemble, and how pressures from either the producers or the networks to say, actually, we don't like this direction.
Mm.
We want this to be more swashbuckly. Yeah. We want Kirk to have more freedom to go and be the hero or the romantic lead or the comedic lead or some whatever needs to be done. We don't really like this sort of family sort of like, you know, jocular thing of having women having a nice time of things or being in control of the
military situation. Ship.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to get the leader out there, and you want the leader doing what leaders do. Like
I was also wondering if it's anything to do with, I mean, something I read later on about financial constraints, because they have a lot of speaking roles from lots of different, you know, lower tier actors throughout the thing, you know, even the rec room, the gym with the guy who's
Sam.
Yeah, you know, stuff like this. There's quite and people in the corridor and stuff like this. I mean, the young lady that the Yeoman Rand introduces Charlie to, you know, there are a bit more parts throughout the whole thing here. And I found, you know, I mean, it's a good episode for that, actually, seeing a variety of people that are actually on the ship.
Surprisingly, we're introduced to lots of crew members. It's missing two principal crew members because this doesn't have Scotty or
no,
Sulu
it doesn't.
It.
Yeah.
And so, and the audience at the time doesn't miss them at all because it's only the second episode.
Well, that's the thing. Course, I mean, straight into it as a second episode is quite interesting. That sort of like the. And they seem to be very, you know, obviously the main sort of actors that sort of seem to be quite well formed. Even McCoy, as the homely doctor, seems to be very well, you know, entrenched in his sort of character there.
That scene in the rec deck then the moment that Spock and Uhura have. He's playing and she starts singing and he goes, oh, blimey. And there's a familiarity between them and I think there's an understanding. There seems to be a friendship between them.
I'm sorry. I did it again, didn't I?
It reminds me also of the previous episode, as shown, which was the Man Trap, where Uhura is sort of making idle chit-chat, almost banter, with Spock on the bridge. Quite early in that episode, that's the one where the punchline to the exchange is, Vulcan has no moon, Miss Uhura. And that we only see that in those two episodes, and they come one after the other.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that if you're watching it for the first time, you're probably thinking, well, you know, maybe, you know, either you're probably thinking, well, maybe Spock and Uhura are kind of together in some way, or maybe they're even better, they're good friends. Do you suppose that this is something that J.J. Abrams might have had a look at, or the scriptwriters, or Manny Alex Kurtzman might have looked at and thought for the Kelvin universe, where they develop a romance? And maybe it's those two there.
Either that, or they thought, right, okay, I've got to watch as much Star Trek as possible. They got two episodes in of us, sod this.
All right, so those two are together. Fine. They had great chemistry, actually.
They did, yes.
And initials, and those were those early seasons, early episodes with Uhura are really, really good. And it's a, you know, it's a kind of a shame, as I say, that they never went anywhere with those.
Well, it's quite interesting because it seems to be there's it's a happy ship, actually, and it's a happy cast right at the beginning. You know, there doesn't seem to be much, you know, they seem to all be quite well suited with each other. You know, it is nice to see, and it was quite, you know, refreshing as well.
Yeah. You know. And so Charlie shows off to Janice in that scene as well, isn't it? And uses his power to silence Spock's instrument.
And
to silence Uhura as well, which everybody just sort of like, nobody seems to notice. And then Charlie does these quite impressive card trick to get on with try and, you know, get on with Janice, so to speak. I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, do you think that, I mean, obviously Charlie's straight, and the narrative of the story just seems to be hardwired to this sort of like, this is what young men are, this is what they do. Mm-hmm. They grow up, they become unsure of themselves, they become awkward socially, and they lose, and they chase girls. But obviously, I mean, do you think that, how far do you think in the future of Star Trek it would have to be before, you know, that probably could be a different scenario where maybe he chases boys or
yeah. But remember the thing is this was written by DC Fontana, wasn't it? So yeah. The thing is that from her perspective, you know, she's obviously a well-rounded woman, probably been in the industry for quite a while, and understands what people want in stories as well. You know, she's
Think she's taking Janice Rand's
side?
Or perspective in this episode?
I don't think so.
No.
Because it's very... Because I didn't actually find that Janice is Rand as a character.
Yeah.
You know, as rounded, but this is, you know, as we're used to, you know. I have troubles with Janice Rand's character anyway, because she's a yeoman. She seems like she's just a secretary.
To Kirk.
Well, this is the thing.
Who knows? Maybe we'll talk about Janice in an upcoming episode. But,
yes.
But yeah, I mean, I think focusing on this specific episode.
But that I still found that your,
maybe, yeah, yeah. I mean, how do you feel about her with the way that she's characterised here? I mean, it is interesting that she's written, that this is a role written by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so are we looking at a woman's, trying to get a woman's perspective on issues such as harassment and unwanted advances and adolescence and a woman's role within that situation? Do you think that she, is trying to say something, and do you think she's successful in conveying that?
I think everyone's a victim of Charlie in this. But I think obviously the shorthands are used for this. So attacking Kirk, he takes his power away, and attacking Janice, he takes her power away, and her power is her control over her body, basically, and that's what he's trying to get control of. But of course, these are 1960s attitudes, and they're pretty much still modern attitudes as well. So this story could have been written yesterday, and it wouldn't have been too far different from what we actually see. And that's not a great thing, but it's something it is what it is, and it's something that we can't really look back and say, oh well, they should have done it this way. If this was made tomorrow, then they change it completely. I'm not sure they would, not for a regular season episode.
Possibly Discovery might have taken a different approach with Charlie.
But
Discovery, and that was made last year. This year rather. If you go back to Enterprise, if anything, there's a strong argument to say that Enterprise has gone backwards from TOS in some of its attitudes towards women. But that's an argument for another time. They might have made him gay.
They might have done that, but then in which case, then all of a sudden, then you're bringing in another load of old
tropes and misconceptions,
and then laying that.
The point is, you're still talking about the same old fairly tired tropes being laid on.
The other thing is that we're forgetting that we are obviously 50 years after the actual broadcast of this. We're putting a lot of our perspective on this.
Of course.
At the time, I actually saw that this episode might have been a simple case of one of the big worries of 50 years ago was the emergence of the teenager. And so
you had lots of things, the performance.
Exactly. So all those films and TV programs that were coming out at the time, you know, would have been focusing on the teenager and how sort of relationships with that, because you've got a new class of people, and alien entity has appeared in America, and how do we actually relate to that?
But great that they've made the teen into a classic monster movie. Because that's what you've got. Monster movie here, where by the end of it, you do, even though he's a monster, you do actually sympathise with him. And he has got, he's only doing what monsters do.
Yes. Well, King Kong,
everyone thinks, well, yes, he's batting away those biplanes, but they are shooting at it. Janice Rand, I suppose, is Faye Ray in this, isn't she? The victim. But as monster movies go, this is great, isn't it?
Let's talk about some of those some of the monstrous things that he does. I mean, going back to the gym, then the scene where he zaps Sam. That's wonderful, because he's impatient and he's angry and he wants to fight, and he clearly likes hanging out with Kirk, but things aren't happening quick enough. And then Kirk makes it look like a fool, and he just lashes out at this guy who's laughing at him.
Wasn't so bad.
Don't laugh at me.
Cool off.
Don't laugh at me!
It's quite a little thing, but obviously someone like Charlie, you know, it's a major embarrassment.
Mm. Because both those scenes, the chess scene and the fight scene, or the gym scene, are both sort of expressions of, look, I'm normal and I can beat you anyway. I don't need my powers.
Mm.
But obviously I do need my powers because, like, that's the only thing I am.
Yeah.
And every time he tries to bullet himself, he just realises that his powers allow him to do whatever he likes anyway.
Chess scene is very interesting, actually, isn't it? Because that's exactly that. He wants to beat Spock at his own game without being just on his own terms, you know, without the powers. Yeah. And so when it turns out, Spock beats him, just like hammers him.
Yeah.
And then Charlie's only recourse really is to call back on his powers.
Mm.
Just go back to what the Phasian said at the very end. He said, you know, we gave him these powers to survive. He will use them.
Yeah.
And of course, it's perfectly true because, I mean, he'll lose his temper.
Yeah.
And even if it's only in the melting of chess pieces, it's still something that he will use. And of course, we don't know where it will go. In the gym scene, the lighting in there, absolutely extraordinary. It was shot by Jerry Finneman, who shot a lot of these episodes, and he was asked to play up the burnt and crushed reds and oranges in the corridors, and in that gym it works really well, and the lighting there.
Mm. The direction in this episode is really good. Well, there's a lot of funny camera angles in it, but they work really well. They add that because it's entirely on ship.
Yeah. The thing is obviously they could cut back on effects because it was essentially a bottle episode.
Yeah.
So they were able to spend a bit more time and money, I think, on the lighting and on the sets. That gym was supposed to be there, and a lot of the footage that was filmed was supposed to be then reused in subsequent episodes, but it never actually.
It does look like it.
Yeah, that's the cartwheel thing.
That's the observation deck. Observation. Sorry, that's the briefing room in
right.
Just been redressed. So I mean, the idea was is that we would see those girls tumbling many many times throughout the course of the series.
For a meeting,
that's a good point. Yeah, I really enjoyed that bit.
A bit of a shame.
Of course, that's why it came out so early as well, wasn't it? Because I mean, it
ran quicker than everything else.
Yeah, next to no post-production, it was ready to get out so quickly.
Yeah, going back to lighting, as you said, the focus where the camera is with Kirk and Charlie in the gym. The focus on the eyes, the way that he's lit up the eyes, for both Kirk and Charlie.
Yeah. Well,
they're staring each other out like as a Western. A
glint in Charlie's eyes as well, which has really worked perfectly. And it's, I mean, I have to say the cleaned up version does actually really show that even more so. It looks really, really good. It's a very tense scene. It's one of the more memorable, added also by Fred Steiner's wonderful score, which was used many, many times throughout the rest of the first season parts of
Well, it's quite interesting that sequence of notes they use whenever he uses powers, which obviously is used throughout Star Trek, but obviously
this was the first episode in which it's there. Yeah, a lot of those cues, they turn up over and over and over again. It's a massively well used there. Some of the more monstrous things that Charlie does, obviously he zaps Sam. He gets into a fearful argument, a terrible argument with Janice because he's lost control of his emotions. He goes into her room. He tries to force himself on her, really. And of course, it ends badly. But I think the things that I would like to ask you how effective are one, Tina McGraw, who's the young yeoman that you mentioned earlier, Del, that Janice introduces Charlie to, who's more age appropriate. He turns her into a lizard. And then there's the one that really actually always freaked me out when I was a kid, still does now.
Scared
and
that's the hell out when, of me
when he takes removes the face, magics away the face of this female crewman, and she rocks around there and just. Now, I don't know, what do you reckon, guys, if you're watching this for the first time right now with everything that you know, are you convinced by that scene or not?
Yeah, the thing is, as I say, this is the, as I said earlier, these are the three scenes of four scenes where he actually specifically targets fears of women.
Yeah.
So they're basically disfigurement ones, aren't they, really? You've got the turning into an iguana, you've got the removal of the face, and you've got the aging one.
Yes, that was horrible.
And of course, you've got him trying to force himself onto Janet, which is a really... it's actually quite a tense scene, but I think she played really well, the way she just backs onto the intercom and flicks a switch, and you know, she goes straight to the command console.
Well, she's basically in her 90 as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like she's
he's a slasher movie villain, isn't he, Charlie X? He's Michael Myers, he's Jason Voorhees.
Well, it's just going back to the card trick.
He's a monster, isn't he? But obviously monster in a human form, and then you suddenly do become Michael Myers.
But going back to the card trick, he's got those pictures of her. Where the hell did he get those?
They were publicity steals.
Well, I know.
We know that.
In the universe.
Peering in on her or something.
One of the fascinating things from Grace Lee Whitney's book was about Robert Walker when he was actually preparing for the role, when he was actually doing the role, was that he didn't interact with any other members of the cast, so he could maintain this separation. Because he took a method approach and he stuck with that, and so he to give him that sort of outlying sort of.
So when he went to the cafeteria and they gave him the wrong dish, he sort of did that eye thing.
I don't know. I think he bought his own sandwiches. That's how much a distance he had. That's method.
That is method.
We never found out about the eye thing, about whose idea the eye thing was. I have a feeling, I suspect it was probably Walker Jr., who I don't know how old he was at that point, but he wasn't 17. He was
young-looking. 26, I think.
Right,
he was
so
at the time,
young by any, but certainly an experienced actor by the time he's got to 26. And I wouldn't be surprised if he that was something that he added the old...
Well, when I did see it, the first thing I thought, going away from Star Trek very quickly, is I was thinking about a lot of the sort of horror films that we had at the time, or the 60s, especially the British stuff, like Village of the Damned is what I was thinking of. Because it was always that case of the superpowered child.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, and as you said, the Outer Limits and stuff like this probably...
The next episode that's transmitted a week after Charlie X is Where No One Has Gone Before, which also has an eyes thing going on, and indeed a being with someone with godlike powers, who requires godlike powers and can't control them, and funky eyes. So it's interesting.
But the bad gob episodes, there are quite a few, aren't there? I mean, because you've got the Squire of Gothos as well, haven't you? And whom written for Adonis. So you've got, and those ones, similar sort of themes in there, aren't there, really?
We talked about in earlier episodes of this podcast, and it's a regular theme in the 1960s. I mean, it's a nuclear age. There's massive war, there's nuclear weapons, there's been Cuba, there's been, you know, the idea of power and huge destructive power being used irresponsibly, and what it could mean to the rest of us is a big topic in the minds of the audience and the creators, and they all live in that world. So Charlie's another example of that. I think my slasher movie comparison falls down because as a final girl, Janice is not terribly convincing. In these slasher movies, the final girl is the one who gets the comeuppance, and that's what tends to save these movies from the kind of accusations of misogyny that they tend to have, is that the final girl usually is the one who walks away from this intact.
She's no Ripley, is she?
No, she's not. And I think that that's a shame, because she's a great character, she's a good actress. We started to wrap things up beforehand. So just a couple of words about maybe Spock's relationship with Charlie and Spock. Do you think they could have... Spock's relationship with Kirk and then in relation to Charlie, he is as suspicious of Charlie as he was with Gary Mitchell. He's much more tuned into this. And also he buys the whole Phasian thing, whereas nobody else really buys. Like, McCoy doesn't buy the Phasian thing. I mean, do you think that that's handled okay? Do you think that they could have come about across this quicker? Could they have imagined that something like this could have happened quicker?
For the benefit of the story, no. I think it's fine. I think it's the balance of their knowledge of him and his powers, I think works quite well. I mean, you can look at it and say, well, you know, he's doing all this stuff and no one's noticing it. But of course, you know, he's already shown that he's got mind control powers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just when you do something so blatant, like make someone disappear, that completely, you just can't.
No, we're looking back, obviously, with having seen like a stack of genre fiction. Yeah. And so maybe we would do.
I think as well, even though this does sort of rip off or borrow heavily from It's a Good Life, people didn't have videos, and so they couldn't have seen that episode, although that would have probably been rerun loads of times anyway, but they wouldn't have necessarily seen it a lot of times, and not necessarily. And the same with Charlie, you won't be watching it over and over again. You watch it once and then that's it. You'll remember it, and then
and it's only the second ever episode of Star Trek, so you don't.
And it's got so many really memorable set pieces in it. This has got memorable scene after memorable scene in it, isn't it? Really, this is the even if you haven't seen it for a long time, they stitch together so quick.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the removal of the force field is one of my favourite ones. I love that.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
It's such an obvious thing.
Because you can see it coming. It's brilliant, isn't it? How did they think this was ever going to work?
This is never going to work, And he's got them frozen there, and it's great because the look on Kirk's face is very much, I mean, obviously not deliberate with that show there. This was the stupidest idea I've ever done, and, you know, why did I go through that?
I was actually going to say, I thought that the script was really well done, and there were many holes, but now you pointed out that is one of the big ones.
But again, we're looking back at it because we know what force fields are like in Star Trek. We know that that's just crazy, and he's got godlike powers. Of course, the force field's not going to hold him. But back then, of course, you know, it's a different set of parameters. You don't necessarily think in those terms. The audience brain is not wired ours is, and so I think it's important not be too critical of the audience enjoying the episode.
I mean, the thing is, these were made for television, and at the time they didn't actually have ideas that there'd be people with video recorders and DVDs and Blu-rays and
there was going to be something that I was going to ask actually. There's the reference to Thanksgiving in this episode, which is is Thanksgiving, is it class religious festival?
No, it's not religious. But it is the biggest American festival.
Is this US imperialism, or do you think the producers just didn't think that every line of dialogue would be examined 50 years after?
I think it was intended to come out on Thanksgiving weekend,
right?
Which, if it had been in the original running order,
it would have done,
but it came out 2 months earlier.
I just thought they wanted to have a line with turkeys in it.
Well, they did, and Gene Roddenberry delivers that line.
He does. He is the chef, isn't he?
His only appearance in Star Trek.
Yeah.
And that's why he's got the writing credit as well. And
He
delivered the turkeys.
Got a full acting credit there. Actually, no, because he's uncredited.
That's true. Yeah, we missed a trick there.
He wouldn't fall for that again, would he? Yeah.
let's finish in the next couple of minutes, guys. Let's just talk about that end sequence then. The Phasians then. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, they were good.
That Phasian is great.
Yeah, and the they didn't touch that at all.
They changed the ship.
Yeah, well, that was a bit,
which is good because it was just a big kind of blob.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't change the face, and I was very pleased to see that they had not done that,
because they could have done, because it was just a static shot, wasn't it?
It still works well. So why change it?
Yeah.
I mean, Kirk says at the end, you know, the boy should be with his own kind. I mean, what do you think that means?
Well, I actually, the thing is, right at the beginning, you remember we were talking about when we started this podcast that he had been rescued from this, you know, them being shipwrecked, you know. But there was a nice bit from the Phasians said that he escaped right at the end.
Yeah.
Because the Phasians did know that obviously he shouldn't be released to humanity.
Mm.
They were just keeping him alive because that's the right thing to do.
Because in James Blish's book, novelisation, they expand slightly upon the some of the dialogue from the Thasians. They say that the crash was their fault, was the Thasians' fault.
Ah, right.
That they were responsible for what had happened, and so it was the right thing for them to do was to, you know, look after him, and they had given him the power again, as it said in the episode, we gave him the power to survive. He will use it, and they knew this. I mean, this was the thing. I mean, I don't think Kirk's being I think he feels terribly sorry for Charlie. He doesn't want Charlie to go, but at the same time he's thinking that the slightest argument against this is going to change his mind, because this is just a awful situation.
It is a very powerful ending, with the way that he disappears.
Yes.
And taken away, very much like the end of The Squire of Gothos, isn't it, really, when the bigger powers come along and take away your toys. Yeah, it does feel like a defeat. And it is a defeat for Kirk, because everything he tried, he failed to do in this episode, eventually.
Yeah,
and,
well, he was reduced to pounding on a 17-year-old boy in order to try and get him. I mean, nothing worked.
Yeah, and the only thing, really, I mean, the only thing that stopped him from annihilation was the fact that it was intervention from an alien race. And, and you've seen how difficult that is.
So. We don't know, do we? Because we don't know whether or what would have happened if they had gone through that plan of switching everything on and putting him off. But really, all that would have happened is they would have put him under. I mean, were they going to kill him? Yeah. Were they going to kill him, do you think?
Yeah, and how were they going to contain him?
What was the plan?
There was no plan, was there? No, that was the thing. And it was... What's happened, because they've all come down to his level, haven't they?
Yes,
they've all come down to the adolescence level. Yeah. It's like, what are we going to do? We're going to we're going to have to behave like him and just beat him up.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, going back to what they would do with him, I mean, is there a death penalty in the Federation?
If you go to Talos 4.
If you go to Talos 4, that's the only death penalty, which is bizarre.
So there's a lot of parallels between the stories here, isn't it? Yeah. An alien race with a crash chip, and someone who grows up with amongst the well, that was meant to be Venus' story, wasn't it? She was meant to be a child on the ship, wasn't she?
Yes,
and,
grow
up with it. Yeah. That's a reuse of that one. But of course, the parallels in this story with Whom Gods Destroy as well, isn't there? With the powers that are given to Garth by an alien race, and he misuses them and goes mad as well.
So. But that final exit though is fantastic.
Take me. I can't even touch them. Janice. I can't feel. Not like you. They don't love. I want to stay.
That effect definitely holds up now, and they do use it. They use it again in Squire of Gothos, and they use it in Who Mourns for Adonai, and they use it in And the Children Shall Lead as well, which was one of the more forgettable episodes of Star Trek. It just rolls the whole thing off, and everyone is really sad, and there's that feeling of total failure. You know, this has gone very badly. Mm-hmm. They're all lucky to be alive. And something truly terrible has happened. This a young boy, a child, has been taken away from them.
And there's that set piece of the camera pulling back from the wall, standing around. And Janice going up to Kirk and...
In a 90.
sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't dwelt upon Kirk's feelings towards Janice. Perhaps we'll do that.
Well, you don't really see much in this anyway.
But I think what we can do... is I think we can leave it there for now. Because I think we've had it. Is there anything else you wanted to say about this episode that hasn't been said?
No.
Okay.
All good.
In that case, we will leave it there. Thank you for listening to Whom Pods Destroy. We hope you enjoyed our discussion of Charlie X. And if you have anything to add to our discussion or feel we've missed something, then don't hesitate to get in touch. The best way to contact us is on Twitter at Whom Pods Destroy. Or via email. Yes, email at garth@whompodsdestroy.com. Next time, we'll be talking about Yeoman Janice Rand. So until then, from me, Terry DeFellin, and from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
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 It's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.